Walker Sagal Cuthbert, coordinator at Don't Divide Us and educational advisor.
Alka, thank you very much indeed for talking to the History Reclaim podcast series today. First of all, let's just give a snapshot of how you got involved with History Reclaimed. Am I right in saying you don't like the term white privilege?
I think the term white privilege is really unhelpful because it starts with skin colour as the most important criteria for classifying human beings. So it's fundamentally divisive. And then on top of that, it further divides us by allocating skin colour groups onto a conceptual grid of power relations, so it sticks with us onto this grid that doesn't really fit with reality very well. As to your question, why I got involved, well, I could see all around, as someone involved in education and more broadly, that history was just like being treated really in a cavalier fashion. And it was almost like it's being used, kind of cherry-picked it to address the problem in the present day. And I felt, to a certain extent, we all do that. We look back to the past to try and make sense of what's happening today. But this is something different. This is like people really trying to make very strong moral claims and claims for status and resources on the basis of a very selective reading of the past. And I thought that's really, really, I thought, very corrosive intellectually, but also kind of ethically and politically really a no-no. So that was, when I heard about History Reclaimed, I thought that an incredibly important, valuable thing to be getting involved with, really.
And the argument about white privilege suggests that white people don't realise the privilege that they have in the past hundreds of years, because black and ethnic minority people, not only have they been suppressed, but importantly, their history and the history of colonialism has suppressed them. Is that right?
That's right, yes. I mean, it has two strands to it, really. One is the sort of psychological thing, which is that, a white person could never understand the experiences of a black person, which is kind of a banal truth, but actually you could say that of any individual. You can't actually experience what any other individual experiences directly. But then there's the other strand, which is kind of nods to history, but in a very vague way, really, which is that, at some point in history, usually around the time of the Enlightenment, white European nations developed ways of appropriating and using, it's like a cultural and intellectual appropriation of non-white, non-European countries, and created the set of intellectual standards and criteria, which include things like logical coherence, empirical evidence, seeking for truth, and that those tools, those really, really important tools, bedrock of reasoning, are then presented as indistinguishable from the power relationships in which those horrible deeds were taken. So people who advocate for white privilege have a very anti-realist position about knowledge itself. It's almost like it doesn't exist. It's only reducible to power.
And you object to it because you say it's confused about the truth. But history has always rewritten truths. So what's different now?
Yeah, I mean, that's true, because history, it's not like a natural science. I would put it there. I know some people try and think of it as a science or make it a science, but I would take it far more, along the, closer towards the humanities as an interpretative discipline. It's not like the arts. It has an empirical basis. There's always been, a contestation of different kind of historiographical methods. Do we go down the route of, studying the archives for years like Ranke did, or do we believe more in the idea of getting distance from a particular event to be more objective? So the different statuses afforded to artifactual evidence. And I mean, today you would also look at, scientific developments and how they affect the ability of historians to date things and bring up new questions. So it's always revisable, just like any truth claim in a discipline, whether it's in physics or painting, a claim is always revisable. But the key thing is the criteria on which you predominance to. In academia, that should be disciplinary criteria, because if you don't have that, then you leave that subject really open to social and political ways of organising ideas. You know, then it becomes far closer to a kind of social, political, you know, the history is who literally has the loudest voice in society, rather than the history that is most, has the better powers of explanation, that can explain the contradictions of things and the nuances of things. Instead of that, we get a very simplistic, you know, goodies and baddies history.
All right, but let's just go backtrack, Alka, on something you said. You said that history is always revivable. So doesn't that just prove that at History Reclaimed, you're the old guard? And when you label the new guard woke, what you're doing is really stopping societal progress.
No, I really disagree with that. It's often put forward that the old guard, if you like, or old ways of thinking are a block to taking society forward. But I think that's really wrong. I think the societal progress that we have made, whether you're going back to the days of empire or more recently, to say the end of the Cold War, society has progressed. We have made gains. We have made material gains and ethical gains as well. And I think those gains have been made on the back of those traditional and ethical norms. Now, that doesn't mean to say we don't have inequalities today. We do still have inequalities at a national level and also between nations. But I think these inequalities are just as likely, if not more likely, to be the result of ignoring or breaking the established norms. I don't think they are the result of those norms themselves. So the idea that we have to get rid of them and institute a new way of thinking or a new set of values is fundamentally wrong.
And you say that the decolonising theories have severe limitations. I'd like to ask you if you just give us an example of that. But to pick up on one thing you've also said, you've spoken twice about the dangers of simplifying history in this way.
Yeah.
Are you worried about the suppression of free speech? We know about it elsewhere in the world, but would you compare no platforming in Great Britain today with suppression of speech elsewhere in the world?
Well, I mean, for me, freedom is just fundamental. It's absolutely fundamental. And it's not to do with, you know, even like sort of freedom in a social sense. It's just fundamental to being human. As in human beings, as in the species of humans, we are free from the kind of determinations that other living beings have. And that's, you know, that fundamental, that is freedom to think and freedom to speak. You know, they're very, very, very closely related, if not the same thing. You can't really think without speech. You remember a few years ago, there was a historian in Palmyra who was beheaded by ISIS because he wouldn't reveal the sources. The guardian of the museum and artifacts, and he wouldn't reveal them, he hid them. And because of that, he actually, you know, paid the ultimate price, really. And it just struck me, you know, this sort of, that real kind of hatred and anger of symbols of the past. Now, you know, I'm not saying Black Lives Matter or anybody in sort of going arguing that identity politics like that in the West are the same. They're not killing people, they're not beheading people. But the structure of thinking, the kind of the similarity of values, that hostility to the past rather than a more kind of open-minded approach to the past, I think is similar. And I find that really deeply disturbing.
And then how do you plan? You said that you are going to be on a platform with others, including parents and students, to discuss the concept of white privilege at the end of November. But why is it so important for you to be on that platform and not to be no platformed?
What I would like is to be on a platform with somebody who thinks I should be no platformed. That would be a very good debate. At the moment, we have a situation where the concept of white privilege has an existence within rarefied academia, which is a kind of theoretical point of discussion within a so-called theory. I personally doubt that it is actually a theory. It's more like a belief system, but that's secondary. But the point is that has really spilled out of seminar rooms and the ivory towers. It's spilled out much wider into society, and it's become something that is used by virtually every single public institution, from transnational corporates like Apple to the local education authority and schools, who are employing groups of so-called experts, or they will appoint somebody on their staff to become a lead in EDI, which is Equality, Diversity and Inclusion, or Equity, Diversity and Inclusion. It's like suddenly this new kind of layer of administrators and bureaucrats have been created, and they're looking around, you know, the kind of ideas and beliefs that they're basing their policies on, and these are policies that affect what is taught in schools. I'm an educator, so this is the schools and education that really kind of fires me up. What is taught in schools and how it's taught in schools. And it's deeply, you know, at schools, it's deeply, deeply corrosive. We've just seen that in America of how divisive it can be. And we're seeing signs of that happening here in Britain. Whatever well-meaning teachers think they're doing with it in a classroom, what it actually is doing is delegitimizing the kind of the values that most people hold. Telling ordinary parents, look, whatever you may think, you know, you see your little Johnny playing with, you know, Aisha down the road, and they're playing very happily, and they never even thought about colour of skin. Or if they have it, you know, they just kind of get over it. It's just like noticing different hair or different nose sizes or different trainers. And it's saying, whatever you see happening, you can't believe that, because really underneath what's happening is there's a power play going on around white privilege. You know, it's deeply, deeply undermining, I think, and it will have horrible social consequences. So that's why I think I should be on the panel.
But then there is an argument that history teaching has been stuck in the past. People would be taught about the Tudors and the Stuarts, and indeed those would be the exam questions, with nothing about recent 20th or 21st century history now. Things did need to move on.
They do. They do need to move on, but it kind of goes back to the point I made at the beginning. It's a, what is your criteria for changing anything in the curriculum? That's really, really important. Also, I think really often when people are making this argument for changing and getting with it, getting with the times, and, you know, not being an old fuddy-duddy, they're often setting up a straw man vision of what is actually happening. Now, from what I know and what I've read about what the kind of history that's being taught in schools, it's far from perfect. I think there are lots of gaps. I don't think it has an overall use. There's no kind of curricular coherence. It's very arbitrary. It's not a compulsory subject, though it's left up to, you know, it's a choice at individual level, and it's very much left on to local levels as to what schools choose to teach. I don't think it's just like nobody, you know, a recent survey this year from the Historical Association, a report on secondary teaching, shows that, you know, actually quite a wide range of subjects are taught. Certainly the empire is taught and slavery is taught. Not so much recent history, you're right, but then I think there's always, when you get the closer you get to our time, it becomes more difficult to say what's history and what's politics or what's sociology. But you know, what that report showed was that recent times, over the year, I think, of the report survey, 87% schools have substantially changed their history curriculum at Key Stage 3. So that doesn't suggest to me, you know, that history at school is stuck in the past at all. The problem is that the also, out of that, you know, when teachers were asked, well, why did they change their history curriculum? Most of them said the most important reason was social justice. And that I find very worrying, because social justice is not an epistemological or an educational criteria. It's a political one. That I see is deeply, deeply problematic. So even though they then go on to say, oh, we find it very useful to talk to historians and engage in the scholarship. You know, there's a lot. This is a bit of a buzzword around educational circles. You've got to engage in the scholarship, which is fine. I'm also engaging in the scholarship. But if your starting and end point is social justice, then it kind of means you're missing the main point about what scholarship is, which is about, you know, gaining a more objective and impartial, truthful view, which may be to your political liking, or it may not be to your own political liking.
So just finally, Elka, do you think that by galvanising public support for reclaiming history, you might, again, be able to, if you like, take the initiative, that this is a fight back, but one that wants to achieve objectivity in the reporting of history?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is so much at stake here for the next generation. If they're going to be taught by a cohort of educators who genuinely believe that the point of teaching is to create activists, then we have just lost the such an important inheritance of the Enlightenment. It was not just a Western inheritance. It's something that has inspired people from the country I was born in, India, Nigeria, across the world. Those ideals and values have inspired other people to not just follow them blindly. It's not kind of some Whiggish raving about the Enlightenment, but those ideals are transcendental. And so people all over the place use them to understand and make arguments in their own particular local context, fight for their own freedom, fight for improvement. We cannot just let them be trashed or delegitimized in the way that they are being. So I think it's hugely important. And yes, it's objectivity. And I know it's very difficult because it's always tempting to sort of have an immediate knee-jerk reaction. They say black, you say white, or vice versa. But there may be a place for that when you're fighting politically. But if you're trying to do something educational or intellectual, then we've really got to up our game and make a case for objective knowledge and truth.
Dr. Elka Segal Cuthbert, thank you very much indeed for talking to the History Reclaimed podcast series today. I've enjoyed it very much.
That's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.